Tracy Snyder, assistant music librarian in the Library Technical Services. Is Tracy here? Please stand up. So, welcome to Cornell. Where did you come from, Tracy?
I'm from Chicago, but I did my undergrad degree at MIT.
So we don't apologize for the weather. You already know about the trails and the tofu and all that. Erin Tate, Library Technical Services Cataloging. Is Erin here? Judith Corina, Collections Assistant in RMC. Anybody? Judith? Okay. She was a former temporary employee in RMC, and she began working on September 2nd. And Hillary Wong, also a collections assistant in RMC. Ellie, don't you let anybody out there? We're also blessed with two good colleagues from Tsinghua University Library who are here for a month. So if you two will both please stand up. Don Mun Wu is the director of the acquisitions department, and Xin Run is the director of special collections. So they will be spending their time with us over this next month, and I hope that you have an opportunity to welcome them to Cornell. We're very pleased to have you. I was saying to them, Jim, at the break that we have two very strong collaborations, and one of them is with Tsinghua and, of course, with Columbia. So, it is my pleasure to introduce Tim Neal to you. He is my friend and my colleague and my cohort in Tukul. He's the Vice President for Information Services and the University Librarian at Columbia University. And in these capacities, he provides leadership for not only the library but university academic computing. And his responsibilities include the Columbia Center for New Media Teaching and Learning, the Center for Digital Research and Scholarship, the Copyright Advisory Office, the Center for Human Rights Documentation and Research. Before coming to Columbia, he served as the Dean of University Libraries in Indiana, so Ella, I think, overlaps with him some, and at Johns Hopkins University, and held administrative positions in the libraries at Penn State, Notre Dame, and the City University of New York. Jim's career reads like a veritable who's who in the profession. He is on the OCLC board and is currently the treasurer of the ALA. He's on the board and served as the president of the Association of Research Libraries. He served on the board and chaired the National Information Standards Organization and is on the board of the Freedom to Read Foundation. He also is active internationally in many committees and is a member of the International Federation of Library Associations. He's a frequent speaker at national and international conferences, known mostly for his clutter titles. He's also a consultant and published author, and has focused a lot of his attention on scholarly communication, intellectual property, digital library programs, organizational change, and human resource development. He served on the scholarly communication committees of ARL and ACRL and is chair of the steering committee of SPARC. He represented the American library community in testimony on copyright matters before Congress, has been an advisor to the U.S. delegation at the World Intellectual Property Organization Diplomatic Conference on Copyright, has worked on a number of advisory committees on copyright policies, including serving as a member of the U.S. Copyright Office Section 108 Study Group, which met for 3 years, but Julie Kelly and Peter Hurdle was also on that group. In 1997, he was selected the Academic Librarian of the Year by the ACRL and was the 2007 recipient of ALA's Hugh Atkinson Memorial Award and in 2009, the ALA's Melvin Dewey Medal Award. And just this year, he received an honorary Doctor of Laws degree from the University of Alberta. So, Jim is here to talk to us about parabiosis in the academic research library community to school as parable or paradigm or paradigm. Now, you may be like me, you may have known what this term meant, but I looked it up. And actually so did Ed Weissman, and he shared with me two definitions. One of them is reversible suspension of obvious vital activities. I'm hoping that's not what he is talking about in terms of two goals. And the other is anatomical and physiological union of two organisms. So, Jim.
Thank you. It's not fair on the person who introduced you to steal the third part of your talk. I'm really pleased to be here. I've visited the Cornell campus many times, and this is a great opportunity for me to learn a lot more about Cornell University, the work that you do here, and to share with you some of my thinking about where research libraries are at and perhaps where they're going, and how our collaboration between Cornell and Columbia helps us move forward as institutions, better serving our faculty and students in hopefully some innovative ways. I'm always amazed when I can find a word that absolutely captures what I want to say. And I was reading something, and I always like to look something up as I read it. I don't like to pass over it. And so when I encountered this word parabiosis, I have to know what it meant. And as Anne has already told us, I like to think this first definition is a little softer. That is the joining together of two organisms so they can share a common circulation. Maybe that's energy. Maybe that's intellectual property. Maybe that's innovation. Maybe it's leadership. Maybe it's operations. But ultimately, it's all about how we better serve our communities. The natural union of two individuals. Think of Siamese twins in some respects, sharing certain body parts and other parts being free to live on their own. So I thought this was an absolutely perfect and very desirable metaphor for what I wanted to talk about today. And of course, too cool is the parameter in which I think about and talk about the this parabiosis. And everywhere that I go, and I think everywhere that Anne goes, we are often asked about Too Cool. It has generated a lot of interest, a lot of visibility, and that's why I chose to use this alliteration around parable. Is this just a story we're telling? Is it a paradigm, something sort of an example that defines where we're going as research libraries? Is it a paradigm? Is it something that others aspire to? Or as I understand someone here said, a parody. So you can pick your own alliterations. I went to Columbia in the fall of 2001, and shortly after I arrived, I agreed to give a series of presentations to alumni groups around the Northeast region. And that January, which was a very snowy period in the Northeast, you might remember, I found myself driving down from New York on the New Jersey Turnpike to Philadelphia to speak to the Eastern Pennsylvania Columbia Alumni Club. Found my way through the snow to the hotel, a Holiday Inn, where the meeting was going to be held. I parked my car, went into the hotel, found the room, set up very much like this one. My talk was to begin around 8 o'clock, but by 8:15 there was only one other person in the room. So I decided I should proceed, and I said, I'm going to give my talk. He said, go ahead. I asked if he would show my slides as I talked, and he agreed to run the machine. Gave the talk, it was a great talk that night, and asked him if he had any questions. He said no, he had no questions. So I sat down in the front row for a minute, and I said, well, you know, I've got this long ride back to New York, I'm going to get out of here. He says, no, 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 you're going to stay. I said, no, it's snowing out, the turnpike, I've got to get back to the city. No, you're going to stay. I said, you don't get it. I've got meetings in New York in the morning, and I've got to get out of here. I've got to get back to New York. He said, no, you don't get it. I'm the second speaker. So I'm very glad that despite the rain, you showed up today. In addition to the words that I laid out, I want to suggest that there is an important sense of what I'll call revolutionary change going on in what we define the academic research library community. I think revolution might stretch it a little bit, but if you look at the definition that David Close used in his writings about revolution, I think there are some sort of cataclysmic things going on in our world. I think there's a sense of not really being settled in terms of what we are and what we do and where we're going. Kuhn, of course, gave us the sense of paradigm, the recognition that there's always lots of things going on around us. And at some point, in his definition of scientific revolutions, it sort of reaches what we now call the tipping point, where something really momentous happens. And he was looking, of course, at the scientific revolutions. And Marx, in his work, his theory of knowledge, his theory of epistemology, makes a very important distinction between qualitative change and quantitative change. He questions whether ideas have relevance if they're not turned into action. And he alludes to a pot of water over a flame. And intellectually, we know that the temperature is increasing, but only when it reaches a point, a certain point, the boiling point, when liquid transforms into gas, does he really see the revolution that he's talking about. So there's a lot of things going on around us that might be defined as revolutionary. We tend to think in the academic research library more in terms of progressive change, things that are steady improvement, a sort of a paced movement towards a set of goals. But as Butler tells us, all progress is based on a universal innate desire on the part of an organism to live beyond its income. And in some ways, that defines what we are. We're very often stretching to use our resources well and to do more than we're often able to do, given what we have. Those who speak most of progress measure it by quantity and not by quality. We were just talking at the back of the room about the ARL statistics and what they tell us and what they don't tell us. And we have a very hard time, I think, really measuring our success in terms of quality. How do we as academic research libraries contribute to successful graduates and productive faculty? That's a hard line for us to draw, but one which I think we're increasingly expected to illustrate. And as Gibran tells us, progress lies not in enhancing what is, but in advancing towards what will be. And in many ways, we have embarked on that through our individual, institutional, and our collective actions. Let me lay out some additional definitions, which for me are very important parts of my thinking about what Too Cool is. I think we're very much returning to our roots in some ways, questioning what we are, what we do. And I'm hoping that sort of that move to the primal will generate the type of innovation which I think libraries and librarians have always had, but which I think the current environment calls for in very, very fundamental ways. I think that our DNA is very much bundled up in creativity and innovation. Too Cool for me is a very important part of what I've come to call radical collaboration. Not the sort of the celebrated kumbaya of librarianship, you know, the things that we've always done in terms of copy cataloging, shared cataloging, interlibrary loan, licensing of databases. Those are necessary and very valuable, but something richer and deeper and more extensive than historically has been the case in terms of how libraries have worked together. In some respects, it's going to require that we sort of deconstruct the academic research library and sort of evaluate those pieces that define our work and find new ways to reassemble those pieces. In some ways, that's what Two Petals is about. And I think there's been too much focus on issues of survival. Will the academic research library be here 10 years from now? I think our real goal is one of persistence and adaptation. And I think one of the things that Too Cool is trying to do is to give us new strategies and new approaches to better supporting the communities of Cornell and Columbia. One of my favorite movies is Mel Brooks' History of the World, Part 1. And you might remember a section in that film when Mel Brooks is playing the character of Moses. And he's coming down the mountain, and he's carrying three very large tablets in his arms. And he says, "Children of Israel, I have 15, and he trips and falls, and one of these tablets crashes to the ground and is totally lost. And he picks himself up, and he says, "Children of Israel, I have 10 commandments to give you." Well, you know, the biggest mystery in the world is, what were those five commandments that we lost? But I think there are sort of 10 commandments or 10 principles that I've teased out that in many respects serve as the context for our thinking around how we can be more innovative and more collaborative in our work. And come back to the question of the user. But I think our users approach us in very, very new ways in terms of what they expect us to do and the types of behaviors they're bringing to their interaction with information and information services. I think to a large extent, academic research libraries across North America are victims of somewhat redundant, very redundant, somewhat inefficient library operations. We're fundamentally doing the same things every place in the same way, and one has to question whether that's the best use of our resources. A lot of our service paradigms, let's call them reference desks, don't serve our community as well as they should. Our users approach us with, you know, the ability to take money out of a machine at 2 o'clock in the morning at the bank, to scan their own groceries at the supermarket, to get a plane ticket out of a machine at the airport. That ATM expectation is something they bring to their interaction with all service organizations, like libraries. We're all putting a lot more focus on unique resources, not just the collection resources, but the service, the technology, and the expertise resources. The uniqueness and the special and the intensity of those resources is increasingly important and relevant to the work of libraries. We have not, in my view, achieved sort of the scale and network effect, the positive network effect of aggregation. I think cloud computing, to some extent, is an expression of that sort of moving content services and functions to the web. But I think there's a lot more potential there that we need to take advantage of. This sense of constant change, of hybrid structures, of permanent beta, the notion that nothing is ever finished, we in the academic research library community have generally had the habit of wanting things to really work very well before we're willing and able to turn them over to our community. And I think it's been very difficult for us to look at other approaches and to involve the user in that iterative development process. We have built a pretty robust open architecture. In many ways, the network and the web and the types of open source development that we've created, even the extension into the open access sharing of scholarly work, all of this open architecture has become not just a part of our rhetoric, but an important and growing part of our world. Our universities are pushing us, our funding organizations are pushing us to really think creatively about systemic change. And I think how we work together is an important part of that systemic change. If we just look at the machines that we carry around in our pockets and in our bags, the iPhones and the iPads and the thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of apps that are being developed around the world by very creative, hopefully creative people, things that we want to use on our equipment, this whole notion of collective innovation, and the ability to choose and to share freely or at a low price the things that make our world better. And then, of course, the new economic context. All of us dealing with less resources than we were used to and less resources than we need to do the work on behalf of our institutions. I think it's always good to step back and have a sense of what it is we do, because I think this progression of activities from information selection down through information archiving transcends the nature and type of information we're working with. I think no matter where we're going in terms of our roles within the university or within the larger scholarly and learning communities, these functions are going to continue to be relevant and important to what we do on behalf of the larger academic community. Our work enables better teaching and learning and better research and scholarship. Each of these elements, in my view, represents an opportunity for institutions to work together differently and to find ways to leverage their resources and assets to do these better and to perhaps do these in a more creative, innovative, and productive way. But there's lots of other things that we're doing that are, in many ways, the changing roles of the academic research libraries. Clearly, we've learned how to be better consumers, negotiating individually and increasingly collectively with publishers and vendors for better prices and better terms in terms of enabling access. But much more of a focus on getting our users in touch with the information of relevance and quality, and certainly the types of information worlds that they're living and working in require that intermediary and aggregator role that we play. But we're doing publishing. We're moving rapidly beyond information literacy to play a much larger role in the education of our students and our faculty. We have historically been, in my view, an information-poor information profession. We make a lot of decisions by the seat of our pants. We don't generally know how to do research to pull evidence and data together to inform the decisions we make. I think we have opportunities to do that differently. We've got lots of assets in terms of our content, our space, our technology, our expertise, and I think they all represent ways to leverage our capacity to bring new visibility, new innovation, and new resources into our work. And I think a lot of what we're aspiring to do, particularly in the policy arena, is going to be absolutely critical to our success going forward. We need to care about privacy, intellectual freedom, copyright, internet development, telecommunications policy. All of these things enable us to not only serve our communities well, but also to work together better. So, a lot of schizophrenia in terms of how we view ourselves and how others are looking at us. We're going to be legacy, responsible as research libraries for decades, centuries of information that people are going to expect us to take care of. Those print collections for us, although they may move elsewhere, they still are part of our purview. We're going to be infrastructure that the buildings and the technologies and the people are going to be a continuing part of what we do. We're going to make sure that this information will always be there. That repository function is something that's going to be central to our work. That gateway that we provide to information, information of relevance and quality to individual work, the enterprise and the public interest that we serve. So these are very large responsibilities for the academic research library, and one could argue looking forward that it's going to be hard for any one institution to fulfill these responsibilities on their own. And it's going to take new thinking about coming together as a total community and as both a partnered community to really achieve these types of objectives. There's a very important report that I encourage you to take a look at. It's put out each year by EDUCAUSE called the Horizon Report. And what I pulled out here, the 2010 report is actually out. The 2009 report tells us what they see as some of the critical technologies going forward, and all of this is obviously very relevant to our work, the mobile technologies, the cloud computing, the geo-everything, which increasingly defines a lot of our electronic and digital work. And then they look at the key trends, and globalization, which is something I'll come back to, the use of games as learning tools, the importance of formal assessment as part of our work. The one item that is particularly important to note in the 2000 report is the first mention of e-books as fundamentally a game changer in terms of higher education. And I think it's going to be a far more rapid shift than we experienced over 20 years with e-journals, largely because of the consumer and commercial and popular element which e-books represents. It's going to obviously be a much larger commercial enterprise than the e-journals, e-scholar journals represented. So key trends in the larger environment, and particularly in the arenas of technology, are going to be critical to our ability to move our programs forward, but give us new tools and opportunities to work together in very, very different ways. I want to turn attention briefly to the issue of users. It's, in my experience of working in libraries all for almost 40 years, is how frequently we look at developing capacities and then throwing them over the wall to our users with the hope that they can understand them and use them well. I also don't think we have looked systematically beyond students and faculty in defining the user communities that we serve. I think that as we've really expanded our ability to deliver more content around the world, clearly the communities, the local communities, the Ithaca and New York City communities, the working professionals, those who work around here, who have information needs that cannot be satisfied through their companies or their work, clearly the alumni who leave here and pass from knowledge, information, nirvana to information desert when they move on past out of the university. And as soon as we start to publish more and more of our content on the web, we know that the world becomes our user community. And we start to get huge demands from the global researcher, the global student community that asks us questions because they know that the relevant expertise is here. So looking at our user community in a far more expansive way, I think, is desirable. Also understanding where we intersect with our user community. And it's not just in those physical spaces which have defined libraries, that's obvious. It's not just in the web spaces that we create to better serve our users, but how they use collections, how they use services, what apps they turn to, what are the technologies that they're demanding, how can we as library professionals and library staff be not in the physical library, but in the classroom, in the laboratory, at the bedside. Trite as it may be, we often lose sight of the anyone, anywhere, anytime, anyhow model that increasingly defines our relationship with our user community. And so I think as we push ourselves out of the physical library, there are opportunities for us to think differently about how we serve those communities and perhaps build partnerships and collaborations that better serve those communities and take advantage of the differential and complementary expertise that we have. Charles Carroll, the late newscaster, once noted that I'm able to travel from New York to San Francisco and, thanks to the interstate highway system, see absolutely nothing. We know that the infrastructure is important, and we're working very hard and spending a lot of money to build that infrastructure, but what we hear from our users increasingly is, how can we get more and better content? How can we get more and better access? How can I do things that I've never been able to do before? How can I better control my information environment and personalize, customize my information environment? How can I be more productive? And how can the organization I work for be more productive? I think all of our services and capacities need to be more obviously driven to recognize them and satisfying these needs. Because we're building new measurement and assessment capacities, we're beginning to learn how we know our users. And we're building not only lots of survey capacities and focus group, but more observational, more benchmarking type of activities. What we're seeing less of, I think, is on the other side, the experimentation, the prototype, the true evaluation. But I think the one thing that librarians do really well is that aha element. Recognize that as we intersect with users physically and electronically, we have that ability to extrapolate from those individual experiences and be very innovative in how we build and support our services. We've done a lot of work at Columbia with our students in terms of understanding what it is they want from us. And I'm not going to go through this in detail, but you can look at the types of needs, desires that we've documented from surveys and focus group meetings with students across the university. They didn't always use these words. These are our extrapolations of what they told us. But they really want places to play. The whole notion of building technology sandboxes is very important to them. They are developing new concepts of privacy. We read that a lot about that in the literature, and we're wrestling with what that means in terms of the types of information that's being shared. They want postgraduate access. They don't want to move out into the information desert after they leave the university. And so I think we need to understand and be much more systematic in how we respond to that. Similarly, we try to understand how faculty define their relationship with a research university. What is it that they want as a result of that association? And here's what we've documented from those experiences, and how do we fit into the productivity and success of our faculty. Clearly, we might say that the only place we fit in is excellent laboratory and technology support, but I think each of these elements represents an important opportunity for the library to play a very different role in partnership with our faculty and our researchers around the university. I want to digress a little bit, because a lot of the work that we are looking at in terms of Columbia and Cornell collaboration revolves around our commitment to building collections. And I've built a series of assumptions, not looking at our work together, but at the larger academic research library community in terms of where I think we find ourselves today. And I did this as a way to color and influence my thinking about where we might productively work together. I think we continue to try to build comprehensive collections in all formats. Now, remember, I'm not talking here about Columbia, and I'm not talking here about Cornell, but the larger academic research library community. We pretend that we can continue to do this. And that we, I think, are still very much dominated by the alignment of what we're building collections for to the priorities and funding realities of our institutions. That sounds trite, but I think the notion that we would find a way to work together and be influenced by other institutional priorities and needs is something that is not just part of our DNA and our thinking in academic research libraries. Our biggest lie, ever since I've been around libraries as a graduate student and a librarian, I've heard us saying, we coordinate collection development. Well, that's a big lie. We've never done that. And we've been very weak and ineffective in doing that. And I think for now, it remains largely marginalized in terms of our ability and our commitment to building the collective collection. And I think this focus on distinctive and unique materials is increasingly important. And I think if you look around the ARL community, you're going to find more and more obvious focus in terms of the distinctive and unique collections that we are trying to build. One of the outcomes of this is things like Too Cool, where we're seeing more bilateral and trilateral partnerships to build better access to content and the delivery of information. I think whether it's the Triangle Colleges or MIT Harvard or the UC system or the work we're doing between Cornell and Columbia, a lot of innovations are beginning to bubble up. I don't know where we're going with preservation. I think we lack preservation leadership in North America. I have no idea where the priorities are being set, where the directions are being set, where the priorities for funding are going to be set. And therefore, I think we've got real risk in terms of the cultural and scientific record going forward in terms of its future availability and usability. We also know that if we look at things on a more global scale, national legislative and legal policies make it very difficult for us to move information across national borders, largely through differences in copyright laws and copyright policies. I think the way we have built collections, a network of individuals with subject and language expertise who work with a faculty, a school, or a department to build a collection, requires us to step back and take a fresh look at that. I'm not sure the multidisciplinarity of the work that's going on at universities can be aligned on a future basis with that type of balkanized collection staffing in our libraries. We've got to look at where we fit with teaching and learning. I think so much of our collection building has been focused on the research side and not enough on where we fit into the learning process. I think we're seeing lots of scholarly and disciplinary communities developing their own sets of tools in order to better use and access information, and that's taking place outside of the purview and working relationships with the libraries. lots of focus. I mean, going back to harkening back to our role as publishers, we're seeing a lot of interesting experimentation and a lot of good progress in terms of the role that we're playing in the scholarly communication arena, not just from a policy perspective, but in terms of the journals and books and other databases that are now coming out of academic research libraries, which are influencing the scholarly communication process. And clearly, and we've had lots of discussions today around what role we play in working with our researchers to capture, curate, and archive their research data. All of this, in many ways, has driven us to think much more systematically about building the digital library. And we know that in this context, quality does not just equal content. Quality equals content plus functionality. It's what I can do with that information that really matters. Our largest digital library is the stuff that we license from publishers. And for the most part, we're spending millions and millions of dollars, and we're learning that our faculty and students can't find this stuff. And so we're putting a lot more focus on the discovery side of electronic collections. We're converting a lot of our original primary content to digital collections. That's a very desirable strategy. Some of us are beginning to recognize the importance of collecting the open web, websites and web documents that are lost every second of every day, and therefore the cultural and scientific record will not be documented going forward. The institutional content, both in terms of institutional repositories and our function with the university archives. We know that whatever digital library we're creating, more and more of it is multimedia. More and more of it is integrated with services like teaching materials and reference, and you know it involves the embedding, the integration of software tools that enable people to use, align the functionality with the content. So this is a very complex information collection development preservation environment that I think we're only now beginning to wrap our resources around. The preservation piece, as I noted, is bewildering to me. I don't think we've ever had a very good approach nationally to traditional analog preservation. I think we've got some good tools, collaborative tools in place for dealing with the materials that are being published electronically or being converted, whether it's Portico for journals or Hockey Trust for books. I think born digital is the challenging area that we don't seem to have a solution for. And I think we've also lost the connection between collection development and preservation. You can't preserve what you don't have. And therefore, the continuing importance of institutions like Columbia and Cornell to acquire materials as major research libraries, I think, is going to be of continuing importance to the long-term preservation of that information. We've been a very active player in the scholarly communication arena, and I think this represents opportunities for groups of libraries to work together. I was part of the group that launched SPARC, the Scholarly Publishing and Academic Resources Coalition. We recognize, hopefully in that process, why our faculty publish. It's where they get their promotion and tenure. It's how they share information with their colleagues around the world. It's part of the culture in which they've been raised. It's how their ideas get preserved. So as we create new systems of scholarly publishing, we need to accept those expectations and those requirements. But how do we guarantee quality? How do we make sure that there's permanent archiving? And particularly, how do we make sure that as the scholarly communication systems begin to become far more active and robust in countries like China and India, that it's not the Elseviers who dominate those markets, but that we have a more of an understanding and commitment to the open access models that we're all trying to advance. I'm a strong critique of what I've come to call repository chaos. I think what we're observing in a lot of our repository development, lots of places where people are putting lots of things, and whether it's the disciplinary repositories like Archive, the institutional repositories that we're all putting up at our own institutions, schools and departments are doing the same thing. People are putting stuff on their own website. Governments are demanding it, NIH. Countries like Australia and the Scandinavian countries require it on national repositories. And of course, there's that thing we call the journal in the book, called the publisher repository. What's the copy of record? Which one gets preserved? Which one gets changed? Which one gets cited? it's an area where I think we as academic research libraries have a very important role to play, and I'm hoping one that will color our work together. We're figuring out how TrueCool might be able us to work with big science. Massive data sets, largely unstructured. We know our faculty and researchers want to find the stuff, they want to share it, they want to collaborate with researchers around the world, they want to build visualization and simulation capacities off of those data, and by the way, there's a government mandate in the wings that will require them to capture and archive that stuff as part of the condition of their grants. So this is an opportunity for us, I think, to build collaborative approaches. It's the international area that I think has been a very important part of our TrueCool conversations. We know that there's lots of work taking place on our campuses. We are nearly 45% of our students at Columbia are international students, so we have a huge commitment to global education. We have faculty working, as you do, all over the world, and we've set up research centers in Mumbai and Beijing and South America and Paris and Amman, and these have become platforms for the university to build those partnerships. But there's a lot of challenges in terms of language and culture and standards and just basic the way legal systems work in these parts of the world. So we can benefit by working together in this area. I can't step away from talking about important trends without recognizing the importance of space. And as we move collections out, we at least have the opportunity to rethink what that space will be used for. And I use the term the Trump Lloyd Library, sort of the trick of the eye, where, yeah, there are books on the shelves and there's carols and so forth, but what really is going on in those libraries is dramatically different than historically has been the case. How do we create learning, social, collaborative spaces that are much more defined by flexibility and adaptability? This is a space where I think we can learn a lot from each other, Cornell and Columbia, as we totally repurpose and redesign our library spaces together. I'm going to skip over a couple of slides because I think I've covered them reasonably well. I want to emphasize the importance of leveraging our assets to build lots of innovation and change, but also to potentially bring new revenue into our organizations. When I was at Hopkins, the Peabody Library, one of the most beautiful libraries in the world, was a special collections by day, and we rented it out evenings and weekends for parties. And the last year I was there, we did 82 wedding receptions. So that was kind of cool. And I made $250,000 net. Also, we leveraged our expertise when I was at Hopkins by starting something called Project Muse that was started actually in the library and eventually became a product of the Columbia University Press. 50% of the revenue continues to go to the library. So entrepreneurial work is important, and I think there's opportunities for Columbia and Cornell to really think creatively and entrepreneurially about where we're going. I think we also have to work on this R&D piece. And this is, again, where I think our TrueCool enterprise presents us with great opportunities to define things that we're interested in professionally and individually, but respond to what our universities and our national research agenda is telling us. I think there's lots of reasons why we need to build an R&D capacity because it helps us, I think, answer real hard questions and solve real hard problems. But it also opens up lots of opportunities for visibility and competitiveness for grants and really enables us to build a much more robust organizational culture around R&D. I think this is an area where we're only at the beginning. We've gotten this grant together to look at the future of humanities PhD education, but I think there's lots of other opportunities where we need to go out together, because I think a Columbia Cornell R&D enterprise, I think, would be very powerful. So let's turn our attention towards the end here to the issues of cooperation. We've worked together as libraries in lots of different ways. And you can read all of these venues in which over the last 50 years we've participated in collaborative work. We even now have much more partnerships with IT organizations, corporate and publishers. Lots of interesting public-private partnerships beginning to flow out of this. The Google Book Project, an excellent example. one that has all kinds of interesting problems and challenges associated with it, but very much a public-private partnership. I attended a meeting on Friday and Saturday at Harvard to talk about the possibilities of building a national digital library to compete against Google. So lots of push and shove around the Google ownership of our content. We know that, as I've argued, we need to radicalize this stuff. And I think large groups of libraries cannot collaborate radically. We do kumbaya together as large groups of libraries, and that's a good thing, but we need buy-in trilateral. We need to be thinking very early about how we're going to sustain the partnership and whether there are business, legal, and governance issues that we need to address. We need some risk capital to get these things started. There was a Mellon grant that started Project Muse. There's a Mellon grant that is enabling us to do the early work with TooCool. I also argue that collaboration is the new competition. Who your partners are, in many ways, will define our success going forward. So where are we thinking about working together? Well, I think we need to focus on centers of excellence. Where is there deep capacity and expertise in our institutions that can work on behalf of both institutions? And we know that one of the first expressions of that in the TooCool is the work that Rob Davis is doing around working with your faculty and students and helping to build the collections at both Columbia and Cornell in the area of Slavic, East European, Russian, Central Asian. Over time, we hope to have other TooCool employees working across both institutions at Cornell, at Columbia, and over time, this is a partnership. This is an equal arrangement so that we can build that capacity and share those resources across both institutions in terms of where that staffing excellence will be centered. I think it's a great opportunity. But I think there's some back room elements of this we need to look at as well, what I would call the mass production side. Are there ways that we can do things differently together in the areas of acquisitions and e-resource management, and cataloging, and preservation? I think those are important questions that we're only now beginning to sort of understand through some deep sharing and communication between the groups at both institutions. We've looked at infrastructure, digital preservation, web archiving, e-research management, lots of areas in which Fedora implementation, DSpace implementation, your work with Devo, our interest in Devo, so lots of possibilities in terms of where digital capacity can be both shared and hopefully down the road developed together. And when we start new things, let's find ways when it's appropriate to start thinking about those and working on those together. And that's where grant opportunities may come into play. But no matter what we work on, I think we've got to have a feeling that what we're producing is more quality, more productivity, and more innovation. And we've got to measure and assess our work together against those standards. I think we all know what TooCool is. This is the definition that we've been using. A transformational and enduring partnership between two major academic research libraries based on a broad integration of resources, collection services, and expertise. That's a pretty high-level statement, but I think it defines, I think, in a very effective way, what we're trying to achieve together. People often ask us, why you guys? Why Cornell and why Columbia? Well, we are major research libraries. We are in New York State. We're private. We're Ivies. Many similarities in terms of our academic characteristics. We've had a record at both institutions of deep collaboration. We've tried to be innovative. We both have budget challenges, and I think there's a real will and interest in both institutions, not just in the libraries, but in the academic and administrative leadership of the institutions to find new ways to work together. These are the areas where we have, as academic research libraries, worked together. This, in many ways, is part of those traditional cooperative frameworks, ones that we're very familiar with and depend on. I'll be in Princeton tomorrow, where we have a meeting of our board of RECAP, the off-site shelving facility that New York Public, Princeton, and Columbia shares. We have about 13 million volumes in that facility, so it's a major. And so here are some things that we've defined as some of our goals for TooCool. These are probably familiar to you. They're up on our TooCool website. They've been widely distributed to the staff at both libraries. Whether we get to the point of establishing an independent service entity and governance structure that supports Too Cool, I think is something we continue to think about. And whether we're going to expand Too Cool to Colgate and Catholic University, because you know you have to have a seat. Those are questions. We get asked all the time whether other institutions can come into Too Cool. We also know that institutions want to buy services from Too Cool. So whether there's an entrepreneurial opportunity here for some of the deep expertise we share, I think is a question we'll deal with going forward. Here are the areas that we've been focused on over the first year of this project. We have a document called Tech Services 2015. That has been developed to sort of take a fresh look at some of those backroom mass production areas. And of course, we're continuing to evaluate where there might be opportunities for new models of collaboration for collection development and service to our faculty and students at the two institutions. So we've got a pretty heavy agenda going forward. I wanted to reference one other major project that Ann and I have been monitoring very carefully over the last year, which I think is another example of potentially radical collaboration. This revolves around a study where NYU was the victim library. They recognized that they had lots of books on their shelves in Greenwich Village that their faculty and students are accessing and using the electronic copy of those works, largely pre-23 volumes, and wondering why they should pull those books off the shelf and move them into an off-site facility. Why don't they just withdraw them? And the two questions that we raised were, they need two insurance policies to make that type of choice and decision. They need a print repository, and we looked at Columbia's Recap, and they need a digital repository, and we looked at HathiTrust. If there is a digital surrogate that their faculty and students can depend on, would they be willing to withdraw those 200, I'm making these numbers up, 250,000 volumes, and depend on this as their primary access with a service agreement with Recap and with Conti to deliver backup copies if the Google copy was not accessible or got lost. We studied this, and what we learned is that we need to do a much more national approach to this, that one print repository, Recap, did not satisfy the need. Therefore, we need a national system of last copy print repositories, and that will enable more and more libraries to think differently about moving historical print collections into repositories, print repositories, rather than throwing them out. And lots of interesting possibilities in terms of how the service relationship and the business relationship would develop across a national, if not continental, system of a cloud library initiative. We've talked about assessment and the increasing expectations from our funders, our university administrations, and our government organizations. Lots of new measures that we have to think about. We had a meeting last week where a group of librarians said, we need to think beyond ARL statistics and come up with definitions of what would be measures of success, what would be measures that define what we are going forward. We don't think that ARL is providing us with the information and data we need. We also need to think in Too Cool about how we market ourselves. How do we introduce the concept of Too Cool for our faculty and students in our university administration? In some ways, we're talking about new markets and new products that we're developing and new ways of delivering those products. And how do we extend beyond not just our own faculty and students, begin to think about Too Cool as a service framework for other researchers and other learners around the country and around the world. Lots of opportunities, I think, in Too Cool for us to come together around fundraising, whether it be foundation or federal grants, which we're hoping to do much more systematically together, and also the possibility of reaching out with public-private partnerships. How can we build a relationship for Too Cool with business and publishing initiatives? So I think lots of possibility for thinking about resource development going forward. Not only how we can be more productive with the resources we have, but how can we bring more resources into play. And I think Too Cool will constantly bump up against very tough information policy questions as we move forward. Whether it be issues of government information, or the development of the internet, or simply the questions of copyright, my eyes glaze over, MIGO, that's in many ways what copyright is. We need to have a sense that through collaboration we can achieve real action and better support our faculty and students in our use of content and technology. I also think our academic structures are woefully inadequate to support what we're trying to achieve, and that's not unique to Columbia and Cornell, it's across our community. We have tended to be far more hierarchical and bureaucratic than we need to be. We need a common sort of high-level budget planning group that really takes care of those administrative functions. But how do we create more of an academic-like, what I call loosely coupled set of units across the libraries that partner and work with the academic divisions of the university? And I also think we need lots of wonderful maverick units, individuals who are sort of out there with an understood mission and doing things and making mistakes and building wonderful partnerships. Let me back up before I conclude. The School of Journalism at Columbia about two years ago, decided to move from a one-year to a two-year master's degree for journalism. And in the process of doing that, they decided at the beginning of each year they would give a survey to each of the new journalism school classes. And they would list a set of words and concepts and names, and the students would write down next to it what it was, what they thought it was. And this was a way to get a sense of the general knowledge of incoming journalism students, because it was felt important to understand that capacity for those new students. So I had an opportunity a few weeks ago to look at the survey forms that the new class this September filled out, and two really wonderful responses jumped out as I looked at the surveys. One of the words that students were asked to define was Viagra. And the best response I saw, the drug that's given to deal with male incompetence. And in some ways, what we're dealing with here is academic research library incompetence. Our inability, in some respects, to do the things that we know we have to do. But it's that full array of responsibilities that we talked about at the beginning that in some ways is tying our hands. So I'll leave that in your heads to think about. But the other one, which was extraordinary, the word that they were asked to define was Yo-Yo Ma. And the best answer was, that's how I call out my mother when I'm in New Jersey. I want to hire that student. So I've sort of called out the library community now. And when I'm giving talks, I very often want to lay out a set of actions that I think we need to advance as institutions. I think there are things that we can do on the institutional level that make it more effective for us to collaborate with other institutions. And here are some of the things that I'm encouraging each of us at each of our academic research libraries to take on. You can see some of the key elements. Really focus on that campus infrastructure of technology, where I think we're seeing some major, major gaps. Educate our faculty about their rights as authors and how they can influence public policy and redefine the nature of scholarly publishing and scholarly communication. How can we really build a different role in terms of our educational function at the university? Where do we fit into this whole arena of research information management? It's not just our ability to capture and curate and preserve electronic research data. It's a far richer role that we play in terms of the types of things you're doing here with Viva. But I think there's some collective actions that we also need to think about. And in some ways, what we're advancing is too cool will overlap with many of these elements that are on this prescription list, if you will, for the work of groups of libraries. I think we have some serious problems in professional staff preparation and development. You've heard my getting myself in trouble around the concept of the feral professional. I wrote a paper a couple of years ago in Library Journal called Raised by Wolves, the new feral professional in the academic research library. And it was really all about the changing nature of the Academic Research Library, we documented that in ARL libraries, 72% of the professional staff does not have the master's degree in library science. And that's because we're hiring more individuals into traditional library jobs who don't have a master's degree, but have certain subject language expertise, of technology expertise that we need. But more important is the range of professional expertise we need. HR specialists, fundraisers, web designers, instructional technologists, systems, and so forth. All of those are important parts of our success in building a library going forward. So, how do we feel? In many ways, I think Too Cool creates a certain anxiety among us. I think we see the opportunities and the desirability. We're still trying to understand the feasibility and the impact of how we will work together going forward. McLuhan said our age of anxiety is in great part the result of trying to do today's job with yesterday's tools. And in some ways, that defines academic research libraries. In many ways, we're trying to do the new stuff that teaching, learning, and scholarship at our institutions demand, but we're working with a lot of old tools. Think online catalogs, if you will, as an example. We feel disruptive, Christensen said. One of the litmus tests is that a disruptive technology enables a larger population of less skilled people to do things historically only an expert could. We know our students and our faculty approach us with some really high-end capacity, capability, technology knowledge. I would argue what they don't have is how to find really good information that addresses the research problem that they're working on. And how do we interject ourselves more effectively into that educational and research process? In Education of Henry Adams, chaos breeds life, when order breeds habit. And I think Too Cool is all about life, if you will. There's a lot of chaos that's going to be part of this process as we reach an understanding of our institutional cultures and build strategies together. When Albert Einstein came to the United States, he would not travel by plane. I look outside and think about my wonderful trip back to New York City from Ithaca later this evening. But he would often travel around the United States by train. And on one such trip, he was sitting in the car, and the young man came around to collect the tickets. And Einstein starts reaching in his pocket, and suddenly the young man realizes, you know, who this is. He says, "Dr. Einstein, don't worry, you don't need to find your ticket." But Einstein persists, and he crawls on the floor, and he lifts up his feet, and again the young man says, "Dr. Einstein, please get up. You don't need to find your ticket." And Einstein whirls around, looks him in the eye, says, "Young man, it is no longer a matter of whether I can find my ticket, it's a matter of where I am going." And so I think my parting words are, let's through Too Cool find a way to stop looking for our tickets and find a way to think much more creatively, energetically, together about where we are going. So thanks for the opportunity to share some of my thoughts.
Thank you very much, Jim. We are out of time, but if there is one or two possible questions for Jim, to put them in before we depart. Do you want to bring a thing on time? Or did Jim ask that?
This is also very directly possible to my job, but I apologize. But when you're talking about the marketing of people, talking about these products that are, you know, going to be released. One of the problems that I think we have when trying to talk to media or anybody who is familiar with this, excuse me, is they ask for examples. And it's really hard to use samples beyond whoever's collection of other right now. What would you say when, you know, a library journal gets it wrong and says collection development and we call them and say, no, it's more than that, and they say, oh, gee, what is it? And then this sort of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think in the case, and we have just one really good example, and I think in that case it's really service to faculty and students. I think collection development is part of it, but I think it's really all about service to faculty and students. If Rob was just building collections in the Russian Slavic East European area, that would be one thing. But the fact that he is going to be a resource available to the faculty at Columbia and to the faculty and students at Cornell is a much richer and I think higher level set of responsibilities and activities. There is savings that takes place in that staffing model, but we have to look at the ripple effects, potential ripple effects around new models for acquisitions and cataloging of those materials in terms of how we can expand, responsibly reduce the duplication, radicalize the delivery of materials between the two institutions, and build larger collections in terms of breadth that serve both institutions. So I think it's a far... But I also think we're looking pretty hard at some of those mass production operations. How do we do e-resource management? How do we do cataloging and acquisitions at the two institutions? We're working together. We're learning from each other. Are there ways to leverage those two very significant capacities at both institutions? We're going to move content back and forth much more effectively. If our faculty at Columbia have gotten very used to the fact that it takes 24 hours to get materials from our off-site facility to their desk, and they're quite happy with that. If I can do the same thing from Columbia, from Cornell to Columbia in that same time frame, and we can reverse that process and sort of move borrow direct to the Cornell, borrow direct to the top of our pile, and move as much content of the article and chapter level to the desktop of your faculty and students, then I think we, in some ways, raise the bar on document delivery as well. I think the fact that we want to have gone out and we'll continue to go out for major grants is another opportunity. And I think the fact that we're looking at how to build some technology infrastructure together around web archiving, around Vivo type developments, and around research information management, and around e-research data archiving, those represent, I think, new startup infrastructure type developments that we also need to educate the media about. So I think we're all in the first year of this process, and a lot of it has been learnings, I think the real test of this will be 3 to 5 years down the road. That we're in this for the long term, if you will, and therefore we've got to demonstrate value and progress over an extended period. We'll go back to Mellon for more funding, because I think we need to demonstrate in these first 2 years that we can build something creative and innovative together that they want to continue to invest in.
Thank you.